happen. Anyway, so we're going to look at a specific algorithm and, you know, see how all these pieces interact and which bits are important, which bits are not so important. So to do that, we're going to start with a very brief overview of where we're at classically in terms of computational power, and then a specific algorithm people hope is going to be commercially interesting, namely quantum chemistry. So a toy example of a problem that cannot be done classically yet that might one day be able to be done quantumly. And then all the bits and pieces that go into the overhead, space and time overhead of that algorithm. So really, this is a picture we all need to keep in mind. You know, this is where classical computing is at. You're looking at machines with millions of cores, you know, petabytes of RAM. Some people are happy to connect, you know, small power stations and run machines. And, you know, we're trying to build a device that outcompetes these. So it's a challenge that you can't disconnect from. We're going to need a big computer to do this. The algorithms are going to be big. And those statements matter. So we won't go through this slide in detail. This is essentially just the quantized Hamiltonian for a molecule where you fix the nuclei in space, you pre-compute the orbitals. So this is this STO6G. You pre-compute the orbitals that go on that. And you, then you're looking for some combination of those orbitals that is the ground state. You use phase estimation, a Trotter-Suzuki decomposition. This is not by any means the most important thing to focus on here. What we really care about is on the following slide. So this is the circuit that does that. And I'm going to ask you to accept on faith that people that focus on these kinds of algorithms have calculated these numbers fairly well. And so what we care about are two things in this picture. One, this circuit is fairly linear. So it's serial execution of gates. So if you're going to get an advantage from using a finite rate block code, okay, this is perhaps a good candidate for doing so. And that these numbers are accurate. So this is mostly work done by the Microsoft group. So Dave Wecker in particular has done a lot of work in this space. And we're going to take these numbers from their papers and say, well, they're accurately calculated. So what we really want to do, if you recall the first slide, since the controlled rotations are enormously expensive, is work out what is the overhead of implementing this many controlled rotations, right? The other bits and pieces are completely negligible. CNOT gate is also about four orders of magnitude smaller than just one of these. So even if you have 100 times as many CNOT gates as you do these rotations, they're still less than 1% of your overhead. So we're just going to ignore that. Similarly, you can ignore communication between qubits because that's essentially just a CNOT gate between qubits. It's terribly, terribly cheap. So we ignore communication overhead, completely ignore Clifford overhead, and that still gives us a very good handle on the overhead of the algorithm.
Sorry, no.
Yeah.
Are these numbers coming out of that reference?
Yeah.
So this has dropped substantially since.
No, these are, so to elaborate on that, so this is the best number that exists. They have a paper, your paper indeed, where you talk about nesting and coalescing, right? So the nesting, it's not explicit. It's still being worked out. Dave hopes that we can get a factor of 10 reduction in this number, okay? But it's still only a hope. So, and then you have nesting, which gives you parallelism. And again, Dave hopes that you'll get a factor of 10, but that won't change the overhead. Mm-hmm. So there is work in progress, and yes, David has been part of that, to bring these numbers down. But at the moment, this is... I mean, this talk was done with in collaboration with all these guys, right? So these are the best numbers that they feel are reasonable to use at this point in time. But yes, work is ongoing to bring them down. All right, so what's a controlled rotation? So you can decompose it in a couple of steps. You can use a Fredkin gate, so controlled swap, so that you only need to do a single qubit rotation. So this is an important part of the decomposition. And then you can break that Fredkin gate into a bunch of Clifford and T gates And then you use all the beautiful theory that has come out of the community over the last 18 months for decomposing these single qubit gates into sequences of H and T. And you can play a few little tricks. If you really, really want to squeeze things, you can search for sequences of this form that begin with HT dagger, and in this circuit, end with TH dagger. And then you can get rid of another two, but we're not going to that extent anyway. These are very squeezed numbers. We've worked hard to make these numbers small. So using optimal techniques, so that gives you the shortest length sequence, again, that it's probably looking at and saying, well, I have a paper that maybe is going to give me lower head. We're looking at that. Maybe it will. You know, we're going to look at the details of how it falls out in the surface code. There are some options to bring this overhead down further. We're also going to assume that errors don't add badly. So we're going to be quite optimistic in how things add up. So we're going to assume that when we implement a rotation, if we have some error in the angle, it's going to lead to an error that is, in terms of probability of error, probability of a logical error, of order this squared, okay? Which I believe is reasonable for quantum chemistry. So at the end of the day, we have what is really quite a modest number of these non-Clifford gates to get a sufficiently accurate, so quite a good, arbitrary angle controlled rotation. So very squeezed numbers. The next thing we want to do is we want to work out, well, how long is this algorithm going to take to execute? And in the first case, we're going to optimize for time. So we're going to push everything we can to be parallel. Now, what you can do with any quantum algorithm is decompose it in the following manner. Get your gate set, make it Clifford and T, and then arrange it into layers of, here's a Clifford circuit, a layer of T, another Clifford circuit, a layer of T. That's generic. Any algorithm, you can do that. And then what you can do, if you wish, is you can write the layer, the Clifford circuit, and then your layer of T, and then your Clifford circuit, and then your layer of T. This is a generic construction. You can take any quantum algorithm and perform the non-trivial quantum part, barring some identity gates, in constant time. Doesn't matter what your computer is. The only thing this relies on is that the error correction code you use has the following property. You can measure logical X and logical Z transversely using physical X and physical Z with no transformation required between those two measurements, right? So provided you can apply either one of those two transversal physical measurements and get logical X and Z measurements, then you can do this construction. So this is not surface code specific. This is an example of how to do it using the surface code, but this is just a generic teleportation circuit identity. One nice feature of it, because in such codes you can perform logical measurement in constant time, is the execution time depends in no way on the error correction code or its strength. So you can do arbitrarily accurate implementations of this algorithm in a fixed time. So we don't have to talk about error rates or codes or anything. We can just write down the minimum execution time of the algorithm already. And that is the number of rotations we need to perform multiplied by their depth measured in T gates. So if you remember, we had 51 T gates per rotation and then a couple of layers at the beginning end to make it control rotation. Okay. Plus the measurement time. So how long it takes, for example, form this Z basis measurement, and the time to do the following. Work out if that, what that logical measurement was, which takes time, right? They're kind of random numbers, and you have to do error processing to see what that result was, and then insert a single qubit rotation that selects between one of these two possible banks of logical measurement. You know, do I put a Hadamard here, or do I put it here? You have to make that choice. So for the technology that we work on in UCSB, we think it is reasonable to aim for approximately 100 nanoseconds to do that. An actual single qubit rotation is only 10 nanoseconds. So these are numbers of where we think we can get in the short term. And immediately, you can write down execution times, about 14 days. So this looks promising, right? As people have mentioned, there are ways to bring this down. It should also be kept in mind that we're looking at iron sulfide, Fe2S2, working out the ground state of that. It's not a terribly commercially valuable problem, right? So as we come up with better ideas to bring the overhead down, we're also going to want to go to more complicated problems. So this is kind of ballpark estimate of where we're probably likely to continue to sit at no matter what, because what we actually want to do is simulate probably 25 or 30 atoms doing dynamics, and it's just a much, much harder computation.
How many orbitals are there?
This is 112 orbitals. So, you know, while it's believed to be out of reach of classical computers, will anyone pay for a large-scale quantum computer to solve that problem? Probably not. We need something a bit more complex. But it's a start.
And then this error-correcting code agnostic formulation, for 14 days, how many logical qubits do you pay to get that very short time?
Well, what I will do is talk about how many physical qubits. I don't really care how many logical qubits.
I see, but this construction here you said applies for any code, so we can call those logical qubits relative to whatever code we're adding.
If you wish, but this circuit is for one qubit of data as written. You know, the input is at the top and the output is down here. So if you insist, the top one is, you know, one logical qubit, but in a very real sense, every single qubit I have here that's initialized to zero or plus is part of the same logical qubit. So is this a new logical qubit? Is this the same logical qubit? I don't care. What I care is about how many physical qubits I have at the end of the day.
Okay.
All right. So let's flip it over. So that's maximum parallelism, 14 days. Now look at doing it serially. So, you know, I've allowed myself a little bit of parallelism, but essentially each one of these blocks distills an A state, which enables a T gate. So we're doing our T gates in serial now. And now this forest is all of my data, my 113 logical qubits. And what you'll notice immediately is that it takes about the same resources to do one T gate as it does to store all of the qubits in my data with the surface code. So, you know, if you use a block code, you might be able to halve the number of qubits.
So sorry, this thing that we're seeing is a distillation circuit?
That's correct. So it's two levels of distillation. So yeah, round one of distillation then feeds into round two of distillation. Here's the output that feeds into your circuit. Yeah.
But can you use different code distances at different rounds?
Yes. So you'll see that the first round is much smaller than the second.
Oh, okay.
So yes, yeah, we've certainly optimized for that. Broad ballpark, at the lower level, you can easily use half the code distance, maybe a little bit less. It depends on the details of the exact error model here. This is for using half the code distance, which means each one of these distillations has 8 times less volume. But yeah, so yeah, we certainly did that. We still can't write down the execution time of doing it in serial, because now we do have a dependence on the code distance, all right? This sequence has height in terms of code distance, works out to 3.75D, it doesn't really matter why. If you measure this, it turns out to be 3.75D. But you know, now we need to know what D is to say, well, we have a number of rotations, which converts into T gates, number of T gates for the rotation, 2 more to make it controlled. And then this height here is 3.75D times the time for one cycle of error correction, which we're gonna say is about 500 nanoseconds, which again is about the right number for UCSB technology.
What does that note, volume times 2?
It's just a statement that, all right, let's imagine we have a perfect block code, right? It's only going to halve the number of qubits. Even if all of this becomes 0, it's still only going to halve the number of qubits. Just a caution. I mean, I see a lot of people say, all right, surface code requires a lot of qubits per logical qubit. That's true. And a block code might get down to a very small number. That's also true. But that doesn't mean that you're going to use that fraction as many qubits to implement an algorithm, because an algorithm has lots of other hard stuff in it. So to work out the temporal overhead of doing it in serial, we first need to work out the space overhead for enough error correction to keep the computation stable, because that's going to set our code distance, which then sets our time. And the way we do that at the moment, we're working on making it better, is to use square patches of surface code, and we'll show on the next slide how we use that to bound the probability of error in, you know, things like this, which are much, much more complex than that. So we start with simulations of this form. So this is the latest, greatest two rounds of matching correlated error correction performance, fully fault tolerant, single and two qubit gates only, 2D array of qubits. So just for comparison with the previous talk, we can easily go down to 10 to the minus 5 fully fault tolerant. And this is for continuous error correction, practical. You can put in as many logic qubits as you like. It takes microseconds to do a round of error correction, and you can run it continuously forever. What you get from all of this is this formula. So once you push these things to the limit of low P, you get lovely, nice asymptotics where these are polynomial functions. This is just a quadratic function. Basically, it's saying a distance 3 code can only fail if you have at least two errors. So at a low enough P, it should just be AP squared. All right, and that's what you can fit. That's what these dotted lines are. That's an AP squared line. And you can do the same thing at distance 5. We can't get quite down to the asymptotic region for distance 7 because now we're down to, you know, very low logical error rates. So, you know, it's common for us to run these simulations until we have 10,000 changes. So we're talking about running these things in some cases for trillions of rounds of error correction. And we do that on a modest sized cluster. We have a 640 core cluster, but something like this will take us a few weeks to simulate. So it's a very, very fast algorithm. So how do we convert squares, though, into this? So we call each one of these kind of unit volumes a plumbing piece, because why not? It looks like plumbing. And what we want to do is upper bound the logical error rate per plumbing piece. So essentially, every time you see a small cube, we count that as a plumbing piece, right? And the plumbing piece involves the minimum volume that includes everything, including one cube. So there are certain classes of error. You can connect one defect to its neighbor in this direction, one defect to its neighbor in this direction, and then that covers all of those classes of error. And also you can have an error encircling it. So this is the three in this formula. Then we have two different types of defect, doesn't matter what they are, light and dark, primal and dual, smooth and rough, two types. Okay, and so if that's interleaved with this, we have a forest of two types, well, we'll get a second doubling. Now, that is a very generous upper bound. In practice, when you have circuits of this form, a very large number of errors are topologically trivial. For example, if I have an error chain connecting from here to here, well, it's trivial, right? So there's an awful lot of cancellation that will occur in practice. There aren't nearly as many error chains from this defect to this defect as there are from this boundary to this boundary, because the boundaries are long. So it's a very generous upper bound. And then you multiply by 5d on 4, because this prism is length d in rounds of error correction, and each cube is d on 4. So that's the 5d on 4 times the logical error rate of a square plate. So it's a generous upper bound. We get a nice formula, which is valid at a reasonably low p, factor of 10 below threshold. It's not valid at threshold, but any D. So it's very convenient.
Have you done any simulations of the actual plumbing pieces to see how good this bound is?
We're working on that. So as we speak, I have a student that is working on making the code capable of simulating computation with errors and working out error rates. So it's complicated, but we'll get there.
So these are just for uncorrelated errors, right?
What do you mean by uncorrelated?
Errors are just standard altitude decay, right? So
it's the standard depolarizing model in these sims, but we have considered many other models. But these sims, yes, it's standard depolarizing.
But there are no correlated errors which happen simultaneously on sort of lots of qubits.
Not in these sims, but we have done that. You know, we could use a different, we have extremely similar graphs to this one for correlated errors involving many qubits. We've looked at the case where you have, for example, maybe a wire in your computer that runs from one side to the other and can introduce non-local pairs of errors. We've looked at every case we think might occur in a physical computer, and it's different, but broadly similar. You can achieve good suppression of error. In some cases, if you really ramp up the noise too high, yeah, you cease to have a threshold error rate. So, you know, there's an interplay between experiment and theory in terms of trying to build an experiment that does work and then can be analyzed. But, you know, you want to build a computer that has something close to a depolarizing channel.
But even in this model, the gates,
yeah,
you have correlated errors on the qubits involved.
Two-qubit gates have two-qubit errors. Yeah. And we have simulated, you know, even single-qubit gates have arbitrary, you know, every qubit in the computer errors. We've done that, and provided the die-off is fast enough, you still have a threshold error rate, and you still get curves, of course, significantly higher than this, but broadly similar. We could substitute in a different curve if you wished. So, we have a formula that gives us the logical error rate, upper bounds the logical error rate per plumbing piece, with high confidence. So the total number of T gates is easy to calculate. We have just the number of rotations, number of T gates per rotation, plus 8 to make it controlled. And so it's this number, 4 trillion. We're going to assume a physical gate error of 10 to the minus 4, which is a reasonable number. I mean, it's what people have kind of been shooting for a long time. And if you're going to build a computer that's going to do 4 trillion T gates, one would imagine we will either get there by that time or we'll fail to get there and probably fail to make a computer in the first place. So when you do that, two levels of state distillation is required and is more than sufficient. You can easily get well below the error rate required per T gate when you have such low input error rate. And this translates into needing about 500-ish plumbing pieces per A state distillation to drive each T gate. So we have 2 quadrillion plumbing pieces, but because the surface code works really well, and we've assumed quite a low physical error rate, you still only need a distance 15 code. Recalling that we are assuming a 500 nanosecond cycle time, well, what do we have? We have a plumbing piece time, which is 5 d on 4 times this, d is 15, of about 10 microseconds. And that means in the 14 days we're going to run our computer for, we can execute in sequence 10 to the 11 plumbing pieces. So why is that number important? Because we have a big fat factory we want to implement, and a certain number of plumbing pieces, this 2 quadrillion. And so if this is the maximum number of plumbing pieces we can implement in time, the rest has to be implemented by increasing the space. So we need this plumbing piece footprint to supply T gates sufficiently quickly to run our algorithm at maximum speed. Keeping in mind, this optimization is for maximum speed. So how big does that become in qubits? Well, for D equal 15, what we can say is that a plumbing piece has, for each unit of D, 2 qubits, all right? So this is D equal 3, and you can see you have a data and a measure, and a data and a measure. So it's twice D in that length, and also each plumbing piece is 5D on 4 a side. So you get twice that for data and measure, 5D on 4 squared, qubits per plumbing piece. So it's 27 million qubits, all right, which I would argue is actually quite an encouraging number. All right, this is a classically hard problem. All right, there are seriously options that people are looking at that we are already quite happy will give us another order of magnitude saving on this number. So it's now under 3 million qubits. To outperform a computer that has 3 million cores, all right? These are bits, cores, right? It's actually quite remarkable that it is such a small number to do fault-tolerant, error-corrected chemistry, something that's classically intractable. So these are actually very encouraging numbers to me. I mean, it's just life that, yeah, we're sitting at 5 to 10 physical qubits, and it's going to take us a long time to get there. But, you know, I don't think we should be depressed as theorists thinking we've done a bad job. This, to me, is about what nature really is going to require. to outperform this. So these are the two numbers for parallel, 27 million qubits, 14 days of execution. Now let's look at serial. So again, we have the total number of T gates, so the same, and we have the same number of plumbing pieces for T gates, but now we also need all the plumbing pieces for our data, so approximately double it. It turns out that you don't need a higher code distance. The previous case was generous enough that even doubling the number of plumbing pieces doesn't require a higher code distance to ensure sufficient probability of success. But now we have a big difference here. We have dependence on the execution time on the code distance and the cycle time. All right, and it takes 3.9 years. And this concerns me, okay? So this to me says that you are probably not going to be able to run a quantum algorithm in serial. It seems very unlikely that this number is going to become favorable, keeping in mind that, yes, sure, we have tricks to bring the number down, but very likely the computation that I am studying here is not big enough to be valuable. Iron sulfide's not that interesting, okay? You're really going to need something bigger, quantum dynamics. It's a lot more qubits, it's a lot harder, and if you do it in serial, I think you're always going to be stuck with many years, and people are just not that patient. They don't live that long. So what do we get? So it takes 100 times longer if you do it in serial, and you save a factor of about 40 qubits. So you don't save a factor of 40 qubits because you have a lot more identity gates if you do it in serial, right? When you do it in parallel, most of these identity gates melt away because the data is just kind of hopping around the T gates. The actual overhead, if we go back to this picture of identity gates, when you do this, well, most of the overhead is associated with this, and then you just have a few CNOT gates to kind of move it on to the next T gate. So the overhead can easily be less than 5%, these are real numbers, to implement this versus that, okay? Whereas when you do it in serial, you have to keep all your data happy and independent as you do your gates slowly one at a time. So you have more identity gates when you do it in serial, a higher overhead.
Yeah, but you're not using a larger code.
That's because the way the numbers worked out. We didn't need to use a larger code,
right,
despite having twice the space-time volume, just because that's the way the numbers worked out. You know, every time I increase the code distance by 2, when I'm using the surface code at an error rate of 10 to the minus 4, the logical error rate goes down by a factor of approximately 200, okay? So doubling the volume that I needed to protect didn't require me to increase the code distance. That's all that statement meant.
No, okay, so that I understand.
Okay.
But I didn't understand your argument. So in other words, you're basically saying, finding what I think is an extremely shocking, thinking of what I think is a pretty shocking claim, which is you are, when you serialize, when you let's say you start with the serial computation, you go to a parallel computation.
Yes.
Then you can
reduce the space-time volume of the execution. Yes.
Yeah.
Because you have your data is not sitting around waiting to be used; it's being used. It's getting on with the job.
But if you increase the time to whatever years, don't you need to reduce the logical error rate?
Yes, but keep in mind the logical error rate, the target logical error rate, is set by the volume of the algorithm, and the volume is only double. All right? So the volume in the... Yeah, okay. And that's it's negligible. It turns out to not increase the code distance at all. So now, of course, you can trade off between these two extremes, but, you know, these are the numbers. So, where were we? So, it should always be kept in mind that quantum computers are slow, okay? UCSB works on superconducting qubits. They're among the fastest of the qubits out there, and yet a CZ gate takes 45 nanoseconds. Measurement takes about 200 nanoseconds. We're talking a computer whose raw gate speed is only tens of megahertz, and if you, instead of gate speed, measured in terms of cycles of error detection, which is reasonable, it's 2 megahertz. All right, so it's slow, okay? And these things aren't, right? These things can add 64-bit integers in a nanosecond. So it's a very asymmetric competition. And in my opinion, you can't hope to compete with a massively parallel compute system with a serial, very slow compute system. It just won't work. You have to go the same route. You have to go to a massively parallel quantum system. And what does that mean? I mean, in some ways, to abuse notation, this is a single-core quantum processor, right? It's a picture of the space-time evolution of a single-core quantum processor. Okay, yeah, sure, it's 640,000 physical qubits, but this is the core that does work, one T-gate at a time. If I go and parallelize it, I can just take these guys and make 10 of them. It's fine. The overhead for doing that is negligible. I can easily get my prepared A states from here just using a pair of defects and interact easily with whichever one. So I can, you know, increase the speed of this thing by a factor of 10, bring it down for 3.9 years for about 5 months by just having 10 times as many qubits, okay? But when you do that, you realize that the overhead of storing data is less than 10% of the overhead of doing the computation. So even if our wildest dreams come true with finite rate black codes, you might save 10%. Perfect decoder, square root n, code distance, one qubit per logical qubit, you save 10%.
I mean, you're assuming that you can't use LDPC code for magic state distillation and such things. I mean,
so we've looked at block codes for magic state distillation and we haven't found anything that saves you a whole lot right now.
But I mean, if you had like a finite rate, you know, finite rate distillation scheme.
Sure.
Then you could say
sure.
So.
And that's a good statement. So the key is to not focus on memory. You've got to focus on computation.
You've got to start somewhere.
Well, it's two different things.
You've got to focus on computation. You might as well forget about memory. You really need computation. That's what I'm saying. The memory, you can optimize the memory perfectly. It won't help you. You've got to optimize the computation. This is expensive. This is not. All right. Even if we do it not that well with the surface code.
We don't have a memory, right?
Yeah,
so,
sure.
I mean, I think it's a different...
But just keep in mind the goal needs to be. It's got to be computation, not memory. Yeah.
Why did you choose this specific gate set? Is it that hard to implement the control zero rotation at arbitrary angle?
It's impossible. You have to decompose it into something.
You mean those are protected operations?
You have to, yeah. I mean... Any error correction scheme means a finite gate set because you have to have some fixed points in your space rotations where your code drives you towards it. Yeah, so you can't do continuous. Yeah.
Have you tried to do similar estimates in the regime then only one round of distillation is enough? How much would they change?
Sure. So you would then not need this piece, all right? And that takes you down by a factor of 3 in overhead. Yeah, not so much. Because, you know, this is a 15-to-1 state distillation, so I have 15 copies of this, but each one of these copies is 8 times smaller because I use half the code distance. So it's 15 on 8. So it's approximately twice as much volume here as there is here. So, yeah, you save a factor of 3. It's good, but, yeah. Yeah.
So when people... try to optimize algorithms.
Yeah.
Usually they do it just in terms of number of gates.
Yeah, I'm saying
but,
they should not do that.
You're saying that they shouldn't do that. They should.
It should be space and time.
They
I
should.
Mean.
Well, yeah, okay, but it's okay. You don't when you're designing an algorithm, you don't really want to have to do all of these pieces all at once.
That's fine. Then they should collaborate with someone who does want to do that.
But well, okay, but I'm saying that there's a maybe a simpler version that's. Compromise, which is you're saying certain gates have small angular rotations and very high cost.
Sure.
So maybe you should be counting those as a much
sure.
larger.
Sure. As much as possible, when I speak to people that work on algorithms that don't want to do everything, I say just tell me how many T gates you have and how many layers of T gates. That's enough. Right. But even getting them to do that is very hard. Quantum chemists don't do that. They give me controlled rotations buried in their gate counts. And they count one controlled rotation as the same as one C-naught gate. And you don't even have the data to begin to estimate the overhead of their rotation. But, yeah, I hope that will change. in my ideal world, as a minimum, if you write an algorithm, you would at least work out a quantum circuit and state the T count and T depth of that circuit.
But why T, I mean?
Well, yeah. Anything,
but
right?
I mean,
anything.
The point is that it's
specific.
Why
it's
T?
It's
settled.
An optimization.
No, the answer is simple. Why T? Because it's well understood. And at the moment, everything we've looked at that is a different version of getting these things doesn't really change the overhead very much. You might get a factor of 4 or 6 sometimes, but it doesn't really set the world on fire. I mean,
but
these...
I mean, like, in the past 18 months that you're saying...
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
that's...
how much have we gained if we combine the gains that we've had on algorithm, gate synthesis, and magic state distillation? Like, 6 orders of magnitude, maybe?
So if you just look at Soloveitch-Kateyev to, you know, the latest optimal techniques, it's a heap. But
then quantum algorithms?
It depends what you mean. See, for example...
I mean, precisely the problem you're talking about.
Quantifying...
24
sure.
Lines.
Hang on. Quantifying how much we've gained is not trivial, right? Because way back 10 years ago, we already had exponential runtime algorithms to get optimal sequences.
18 months.
Right.
18 months.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that we did know how to get these types of decompositions just using lots of computational power.
Right.
So, you know, what the 18 months changed? They made it cheaper. Did it bring the overhead down?
Tremendously.
But hang on, I already knew how to get optimal sequences.
No, I mean, not really.
I didn't know how to do it efficiently, but I knew how to get them. So...
I mean, by that measure, you... skip the whole quantum business altogether.
No.
You got the answer possible.
You don't need infinite length these things, right? In practice, 50 to 100 is plenty.
Okay.
And so you can...
50 to 100 is
plenty. Yeah, but you use tricks. There are plenty of exponential time algorithms in the classical world where you can do hundreds to thousands of variables.
But people actually had, I mean, 2 years ago, people actually had worked out circuits and whatnot.
Sure.
Get close approximations, they were much worse.
Yeah. This is a very moot discussion that depends a lot on, you know, definition of progress.
It just illustrates that fundamental research on algorithm, magic state distillation, gate synthesis can, you know, bring down these numbers tremendously. And by, you know, in 50 years when we start building this, the numbers that you are reporting now will very likely be completely off.
I don't know about completely off. My point is very simple. I agree with everything you said, that if you focus only on reducing quantum memory, identity gates are already cheap, all right? You've got to focus on bringing down the hard stuff.
This is a scheme-dependent statement. So, I mean, you could imagine other schemes.
We need to imagine gates, those schemes.
As far as gate synthesis goes, we're in the era of diminishing returns, right?
Yeah.
We've got the T gate.
You know, there are other ones. It's V gates. There's all kinds of gates. But, you know, we have been looking at these systematically to see how much it buys you. It doesn't buy you much. 2, 3, 6. It doesn't really buy you that much. We are going to look at your scheme and see how much it really buys with the surface code, okay? So, you know, it's very non-trivial to actually go and work out all the details, particularly when these things have, you know, feed-forward measurements that determine how the scheme then acts at the next level. Actually then implemented a code, calculate the overhead, and at the end of the day, have a substantial saving, right? So we will see how the numbers pan out. I'm hopeful that your binary scheme will give us a big saving. We'll see. We will try. But yeah, all I'm really trying to say is obviously this is much cheaper than that, and so we should try to reduce this and not worry so much about that. If that's all you take away from the talk, I'm happy. It's a pretty obvious statement to me.
You need this before you get that. That's all we're saying.
That's fine, but provided it is kept in the back of your mind that the goal is reducing this, not that. Okay? Because reducing memory really won't save you anything.
Well, if you change the this, you could change that, like Hector's talk, where you suddenly have these, you know, arches and gates that are able to be done more readily.
And you don't know where the advantage is going to come from necessarily.
Even at the level of this, the left hand side, there's already, 15 squared or something, so it's two orders of magnitude or three orders of magnitude that you could potentially get rid of there. That will also affect the right-hand side because everything there is encoded.
Sure. I'm just saying that in a practical algorithm, when you look at a whole algorithm, the net saving might be a factor of two. And you still have to engineer this. You're still looking at hundreds of thousands of qubits. It's still a really hard thing to build. And you know, how much have you really helped the universe in terms of building a quantum computer, even if the memory overhead becomes zero, right? We need to reduce this guy. This guy's the nightmare.
So is the actual number of encoded qubits that sort of are being processed is about 1,000?
See, I don't like counting logical qubits or encoded qubits or algorithm or ancilla qubits. Physical qubits ultimately is the only thing that has meaning. Because, you know, if I look at this, how many qubits is this? Right?
Okay, no, question is how many qubits can I use if I'm designer of a computation? How many qubits can I actually use for a computation, you know, by writing non-encoded algorithms?
So, keep in mind,
like have a given fraction of GPs, whatever.
Sure, but I mean,
but you get this specific to a specific
computation. Ancilla states drive computation, right? If I have no ancilla states and just memory, I can't do computation at all, at least not with this code. So the more ancilla states I have, the faster the computation goes up to some limit, which we've talked about. So when someone says how many logical qubits can I have, I don't really know what to say, because what I'll do is I'll take the algorithm and tell them how many physical qubits they need.
Question is, in this picture,
how many logical qubits are there? But you need to tell me how to count the number of logical qubits of this.
You know, the algorithm that's written on a piece of paper that says here's how to compute the ground state energy of a molecule uses about 120.
So in terms of the raw algorithm, this is a 113 logical qubit algorithm. The problem is that when you give people that number, they say, okay, so I need about 10 to the 4 qubits per logical qubit. Okay, now I know the overhead of my algorithm. That's just not true. The overhead of your algorithm is entirely determined by this guy, not by these. So I always hesitate to give people a logical qubit count because it's frequently abused. Yeah. Physical qubits are all that matter. Yeah?
Yeah, so I think I just got confused by your terminology when I was asking before. Parallel versus serial. Parallel here just means that the gates are already just in time. You haven't done any algorithmic changes to you just have your enough factors, is that correct? You have enough factories so that you can do a T-gate.
It's using the circuit decomposition. So you express your algorithm as layers of Clifford and T, and you write it then down in this format, which can be translated naturally into surface code and any code for that matter. And yeah. You basically get rid of all of the identity gates in your algorithm. So you end up with a faster algorithm with lower space-time overhead that in some cases can end up using a lower code distance, and you just win-win-win everywhere. And I think this is the only viable pathway to getting to competitive runtimes with the classical computer.
You win-win everywhere.
In the number of qubits. And I think that's just tough. The number of qubits doesn't work out to be 10 to the 20. It works out to be 27 million. I think that's just life we need to accept, and of course we'll try to bring it down by every means possible, but I think ultimately tens of millions to hundreds of millions is where the action will be at, because the algorithms we're looking at here are not good enough yet. They're not big enough.
Okay.